From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Next week, Israel will celebrate its 50th anniversary of statehood. On today's Fresh Air, the accounts of two people whose lives uniquely reflect the turbulent relations between Israelis and Palestinians. The Lemon Tree is a first-person narrative produced for Fresh Air by Sandy Tolan. We'll hear from Bashir, a Palestinian, and Dalia, an Israeli. They've known each other for three decades, but the story of their friendship begins in 1948 with the creation of Israel and the dispossession of the Palestinians. And film critic John Powers reviews a new movie starring Robert Downey Jr., Two Girls and a Guy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Four of the country's air carriers are discussing new links. American Airlines and U.S. Airways say they're working out a plan to share frequent flyer miles and allow passengers to transfer with ease between carriers. Northwest Airlines has announced it's buying a large stake in Continental Airlines to link those two carriers more closely. President Clinton was asked by reporters a short time ago if these links will benefit consumers.
If it's being done to compete globally and there's still an adequate amount of competition so that consumers are protected in terms of price and quality, but American business becomes more globally competitive, then it's a good thing. If it is a function of there being an awful lot of money around in the economy today and it's just one of those periodic bursts of mergers, which may or may not have a good effect on consumers and may or may not lend stability to our economy, then it's much more questionable.
Earlier today, United Airlines, the largest American carrier, suspended alliance talks with number three, Delta Airlines. They, too, had discussed sharing frequent flyer miles and easy passenger transfers. Astronauts on the space shuttle Columbia are studying baby rats. The astronauts are looking at how weightlessness affects the days-old rats as they work on a small gym. NASA wants to see how the rodents orient themselves when they take their first steps without the help of gravity. Experiments could eventually lead to children in space. One scientist says in the future, there could be a sort of family life on the moon or on Mars. Russia's lower house of parliament, the Duma, has narrowly approved President Boris Yeltsin's controversial choice for prime minister. The vote ends a month of political instability. NPR's Andy Bowers reports from Moscow.
This was the third and final vote on 35-year-old Sergei Kiryenko, a technocrat and former regional banker with less than a year of political experience. If the Duma had rejected him today, as it has twice before, it would have triggered the dissolution of parliament and new elections. In speeches before today's vote, many lawmakers made it clear they still did not want to approve Kiryenko, but that they would reluctantly support him to save their own jobs. Yeltsin's candidate received a boost today when the Duma decided to hold a secret ballot. That meant it was harder to enforce party discipline. The largest party, the Communists, had vowed to boycott the vote, but many of its members reportedly broke ranks and did cast ballots. Kiryenko now must form a cabinet and start coping with Russia's shaky economy. Andy Bowers, NPR News, Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 58 points at 9,085 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq is down 5.5 at 1,875. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, Wall Street is limping to the end of the week, while corporate earnings news slows down to a trickle. NPR's Jack Spear explains.
Well, in some respect, Wall Street may be suffering from a case of altitude sickness. At least that has been the assessment of some key analysts after piercing the 9,200 mark, but failing to close there this week. Stocks open lower today. The market has been bouncing around in a fairly narrow range as stocks seek direction. While a couple of the big food companies, cereal maker Kellogg and candy company Hershey, say their latest quarterly earnings were up, both companies said that trend may not last. There was also the news that while American Airlines and U.S. Airways have agreed to allow travelers to share frequent flyer miles, talks between Delta and United have apparently broken off, at least for now. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
A published report says federal investigators are checking to see if Microsoft wrongly tried to pressure rival Netscape into dividing up the Internet software market 3 years ago. The Wall Street Journal reports Justice Department investigators want to know if Microsoft illegally tried to use its market dominance to contain a competitor. The Journal also reports the Justice Department is preparing a second antitrust case against Microsoft, but government officials have not yet decided whether to proceed. A government report finds waste and fraud in the Medicare program costs taxpayers more than $20 billion every year. A government audit found last year's losses were $3 billion lower than they were in 1996, but Florida Republican Congressman Mike Bilirakis says that's still too much. He points out that 11 cents from every Medicare dollar is wrongly spent. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's program, The Lemon Tree, a special documentary marking the 50th anniversary of the State of Israel and the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. For many Jews, the creation of modern Israel meant a return from 2,000 years of exile and gave them a safe haven they lacked during the Holocaust. But the birth of the Jewish state, endorsed by the United Nations partition plan in November 1947, also meant dispossession for the Palestinians. 700,000 Palestinians fled their villages and towns during the fighting in 1948. For Israelis, it was the War of Independence. For Palestinians, it was the Nakba, or catastrophe. Today we consider the roots of the Arab-Israeli conflict in a deeply personal way, from two people who know no other home than the land they each claim. Our story comes from Homelands Productions, producers of documentaries from the U.S., Latin America, India, Bosnia, and the Middle East. Homelands producer Sandy Tolan says the story is about an Arab, an Israeli, and an old lemon tree.
Bashir al-Hayri was six when his family fled the town of Ramleh in old Palestine. It was July 1948, 2 months after Britain's withdrawal from Palestine, Israel's declaration of statehood, and the beginning of the Arab-Israeli War. By July 48, the balance of power had shifted toward the Jewish state. Israel launched an offensive to establish a corridor between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. The Palestinian cities of Lod and Ramleh were in the line of that assault, and Bashir, 6 years old, suddenly found himself a refugee in the West Bank town of Ramallah. 3 months later, Dalia Ashkenazi arrived in Israel from Bulgaria. Dalia was an infant. She was told she was the only one on the boat who didn't get sick. Dalia's family escaped the Holocaust, like most Bulgarian Jews, yet nearly all of them, 50,000, moved as one to the new Jewish state. Dalia's family moved to Ramleh, the town Bashir's family had fled. For 19 years, Bashir's family lived in exile in the West Bank. Dalia's went about making a new society. But after the Six-Day War, many Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza were allowed to enter Israel to visit their old homeland. Bashir remembered his father's stories of the land of Palestine, the house in Ramleh, and the family's cherished lemon tree. And so one day in July 1967, Bashir found himself in an Israeli bus station in West Jerusalem. That's where our story begins.
كل ما في المحطة صامت وبارد. الجو والوجوه. أقترب من مرآة مثبتة على أحد الجدران.
Everything at the station is cold and silent. The walls and the faces. I approach a mirror on the wall and have a look at myself as if to make sure I was suited for the encounter, as if I were preparing to meet a lover. My cousin woke me from my thoughts. The bus is leaving.
Whenever I heard a language, it was a language that was filled with threat for me, the language of the enemy. We knew there was a propaganda against the so-called Zionism, whatever that meant to the Arabs, trying to convince us that Israel was not our place, The choice was either you go on your ships back to where you came from, or we push you into the sea. Some choice.
We were three, my two older cousins and me. Each of us chose a window seat, sitting in a row, one behind the other. We were filled with infinite dreams.
The fear and the horror of it cannot be described. The Six-Day War was in 67, so I was 19, 20 years old. You know, you just felt completely entrapped. That's how we felt. And we were biting our nails, not knowing what should we do now, you know? What?
The journey began. It was a journey of expectations, a journey of love and pain. We devoured each scene that passed before our eyes. Who would have thought that would have entered our homeland as strangers?
I will never forget it. The fact that we couldn't be accepted here, it was very clearly stated, and because we who have just come out from Europe, we had to take sick fantasies seriously. I had repeated dreams night after night as I was growing up of Nazis in Israel, you know, trying to round me and my family and my friends up. Wherever we escaped, they were there. If we went this alleyway, they would come up this way, and if we came this alleyway, they would. There was no way out.
We got off the bus, and at that moment, memories came rushing back, as if 18 years had never passed. We were in our hometown, speaking our own language, walking freely down our old streets in Ramleh.
From time to time, I would ask my parents and other people, who were the people who lived in these Arab houses before, and why did they leave? And we were always told, people fled and left the boiling soup on the table, you know. So it sounded like some kind of a cowardly escape.
We were walking toward my house. I was confronting the unknown, lost in thought. How was I going to be received in that house? Who was going to be behind those closed doors?
And I sort of tried to imagine what it is like to be so afraid that one would have to leave everything.
Have you ever seen a lover drawn with a hidden magic toward his shrine, pulled by an invisible power that is beyond his comprehension? That was my state when a voice came from my depths. This is my home.
And I was in a summer vacation from the university, alone at home. My parents were working.
I was wary. Should I knock forcefully and risk intimidating the people inside? Or knock softly and risk that the people would not hear me? I looked for the bell. I found the bell. I pressed the bell.
And the doorbell of the big gate rang.
I was taking everything in. I looked at the walls of the house, the windows, the trees. I saw the flowering tree. It has beautiful scent. And the towering palm tree, taller than the house. And I saw the lemon tree. After a few seconds, I heard a voice in Hebrew saying, "Kien kien," which means yes.
And when I opened, I saw these three men with suits and ties in the summer of July in Israel.
And I found myself face to face with a young woman in her 20s.
I saw them And it was as if it was a revelation. I knew who they were. They were very wary and very shy, and they didn't know how they would be received. But it was like in a split second, it was like as if I was always waiting for them.
I told her, I am the son of the man who owned the house, who lived here before 1948, and I lived here too.
It is very strange, but I knew at that moment that it was like completing a puzzle. It was like the second part of an unfinished reality was there, confronting me.
And I said, is it possible for me to come in and see the house?
And I opened the door wide and I said, yes, to come in.
لهلا ما تعرفناش يعني على بعض انا بشير عرفت على اللي معي
I said we haven't been properly introduced I am Bashir and these are my two cousins she said I am Dalia and I study at Tel Aviv University she entered and I followed her and we started going around the house
كنت كل غرفة طبعا ادخلها دخلت كل غرف البيت
Every room I entered I felt that I was entering a sacred place I tried to touch everything, to take in everything. The walls, the doors, the ceiling, the windows, the floors, the colors, everything. She asked me, when you left, how old were you? I said, around 6 years old. She said, I came here when I was 1 year old. Where did you sleep? She asked me. Which was your room? And that conversation was taking place in the room where I slept when I was a child. And she said, this is where I sleep. This is my room.
My recollection is that Bashir said that this was the room where he was born. I became very self-conscious then that I put a poster on the wall that was then on the cover of Life magazine of a handsome officer in the Suez Canal with an Uzi, holding an Uzi in his hand with a big smile, like saying, we've made it. And I was at the time very proud of this image, which was a symbol of liberation and warding off a threat and being alive. And there was this poster over my bed, you know. I suddenly realized that they must be looking at this poster with very different eyes and very different feelings than I do.
We said goodbye, we gave her our address, and we invited her to visit us in Ramallah. We thanked her for her reception and her kindness. She said, you can come anytime. The house will be open for you. We went back to Ramallah by bus, carrying new burdens on our chests. And then Dalia started visiting our house. She came unannounced. We were surprised when she entered the house. Of course, I invited her, but we had not set a date.
When I came there, it was an amazing experience. Because, you know, the whole family came and they looked at this strange being. So it seemed to me, you know, was living in their home, and this was probably the first Israeli they ever saw. And they brought all these wonderful cookies and tea and coffee, and I felt very safe and protected among them.
We sat and talked about politics and religion and literature. We talked about how we were dispossessed and about the unfolding of the Palestinian tragedy.
I said, okay, you know, I live in your home, and this is also my home. It's the only home I know. So what shall we do? You know, there was a problem of language. And Bashir spoke some English, so we started talking about my home, your home. And I started expressing my understanding of their sense of exile through my longing to Zion, to Zion, to Israel.
They feel that a homeland means security. And outside this homeland, they are despised. But Palestine, geographically and demographically, is part of a bigger Arab world. It's in the middle of a sea of Arab culture. I used to tell her, your dream of living on an isolated island where you can practice a pure Jewish life is like the fantasy of Robinson Crusoe. It's a fantasy. It's not real.
You see, sometimes we hear, yes, the state of Israel exists just because of the Holocaust. The only moral justification is the Holocaust. And there are some very deep components. It's not just memory. It's the spiritual nourishment that comes from these memories. Because otherwise, how can we understand the survival of the Jewish people against all odds? You know?
They build their yearnings and dreams on myth. We base our dreams on the bones of our ancestors, on our history here. It's difficult for us to understand how they see history with one eye. They don't look at the facts that they don't want to see. There are 4 million Palestinians living in exile. Why should they remain abroad? The solution is one secular, democratic state where everyone lives equally.
I felt that the two things were happening simultaneously. On the one hand, on the personal level, there was the establishment of a bond through a common fate. And this was an amazing situation to be in, you know. Everybody could feel the warmth and the reality of here, people are meeting and meeting the other, and it was real and it was happening. And on the other hand, intellectually, we were conversing of things that we couldn't see, possibly see how. They seemed totally mutually exclusive. That my life here is at their expense, and if they want to realize their dream, it's at my expense.
I felt that with every conversation, with every dialogue we had, there was a change taking place in the way she was thinking about us.
And I felt that I was incredibly accepted. Just the very fact that I opened that door gave me trust and gratitude that I cannot even express in words, because I've never met such gratitude before, just for the fact that I opened that door.
We're featuring The Lemon Tree, a documentary from Homelands Productions. We'll continue after this break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Let's continue with The Lemon Tree, a story from the Middle East.
At approximately 5 minutes to 10 this morning, Jerusalem time, a bomb exploded outside one wing of the
lawn.
We saw blood, wounded people, suffering, pain, dead people. These are some of the pictures that I can really remember.
Matthew Houghton of the CBC in London says the British feel that the stage is set for a terrible and bloody civil war in the Holy Land. He reports from London.
The Jews are confident and determined. They defy the whole Arab world.
After I met Bashir, I obviously wanted to know much more about 48. And a student at the university was studying with me, had participated in the 48 war, and he told me about the expulsions from Ramla and Lod. He told me that, yes, they committed these expulsions by frightening the population and driving them out.
في البيت اللي كنا موجودين فيه ومتجمعين فيه كان في أحد الأقسام البيت.
We took refuge in a nearby house. Part of it was transformed into a mobile clinic. My uncle was a doctor, and they used to bring in wounded people.
There was the big scandal of Rabin's memoirs. The censorship in Israel had censored those parts in which he speaks of the expulsions from Ramla and Lod. But of course, the book in its English version came with a full account.
We were faced with occupation troops. They demanded by force of arms we leave that house.
That's the house that we came to. It was in Ramla, and we lived in this Arab house, which the state took responsibility for, and it was called abandoned property. I'm laughing because it was not abandoned, really. People were expelled, but it was a comfortable expression.
كنا عبارة عن كتل بشرية بتتحرك بمجموعات ملتصقة ببعضها البعض.
We moved along like human waves, packed in tight clusters, filled with fear and exhaustion, walking towards the unknown.
كنا نملك المعيشة الكريمة.
We had a dignified life. The moment we lost our country, we lost everything.
الاحتلال اللي أجا.
You're listening to The Lemon Tree, a documentary from Homelands Productions. The Lemon Tree will continue in the second half of the program. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue with The Lemon Tree. Also, film critic John Powers reviews the new film starring Robert Downey Jr., Two Girls and a Guy.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. Today we're presenting The Lemon Tree. It's part of the World Views series from Homelands Productions, first-person documentary narratives exploring the personal stories beneath the surface of the news. Dahlia is an Israeli. Bashir is a Palestinian. Let's continue with their story. Here's producer Sandy Tolan.
In 1968 and 69, Bashir and his siblings continued to visit Dahlia in Ramleh, sharing lemon juice under the lemon tree. But Bashir's father couldn't bring himself to visit. He said he was afraid that if he got to the door of his old home, he'd die. Dahlia continued her visits to Bashir's family in the West Bank. Bashir recalls one visit when Dahlia began probing him about his family's longing for Palestine.
Dahlia said, "I have never seen people like you. You're strange. You don't just like your homeland. You adore your homeland. You adore the trees. You adore the fruits. You adore the earth, everything. I don't understand this attachment." I told her, "I think I have an answer for that." I pointed to a lemon I had placed on the mantle. I asked her, "Do you remember our last visit to you 4 months ago? My brother asked for a lemon to bring to our father. This is the lemon fruit that you gave us." She said, "What does this lemon mean to you? Why do you keep it for 4 months? I said, "You are just telling me we are strange. I am telling you, for us, the lemon fruit is not just a fruit. This lemon is homeland. This lemon is Ramleh. This lemon is Palestine."
One day, Bashir's father came, and he was blind and old, and had to be, you know, really supported when he walked. He touched the stones of the house, and after touching the stones, he said to my father, "There was a lemon tree in the garden, which I planted. Is it still alive?" So my father took him to the tree, and Ahmed stood there. He was crying silently. And my father took a bunch of lemons and gave it to him. And later I heard from Bashir's mother that when he couldn't sleep at night, he would hold these lemons and walk up and down, and that they kept them for years. You know, they shriveled more and more, and they kept them for years just there as something from the house and a gift and a memory. And then came the big shock.
More outbursts of violence and bloodshed in the Middle East.
Israeli 1969. You know, there was this explosion in a Agron supermarket in Jerusalem.
An bomb explosion in a Jerusalem supermarket.
Explosives were put in a jam jar on the shelf, and the supermarket they exploded, and people were killed and wounded. And
more on this from Michael Elkins in Jerusalem.
Two bombs were placed in the supermarket. The first, which exploded, consisted of 4 or 5 kilos of dynamite. The second, which did not explode and was found in a large tin used for storing sweets, was smaller, about 2 kilos of dynamite. It is, of course, natural that suspicion falls upon the Arabs, and that the 150 persons, or perhaps more, who have been hauled in for investigation are Arabs. The police officers would not say when the bomb...
My father, Moshe, called me one day and said, "Well, look what's in the papers. You know that Bashir is convicted as having taken part in this." He was charged with being the liaison person between those who gave the explosives and those who put them in the jar. And as far as I know, it's an act attributed to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Well, Bashir is identified with this movement. The person who appeared at my door, I've learned later, of course, was an activist for the Popular Front. Anyways, after this, I felt so betrayed that all connections stopped with the family. He was in jail anyway, so... But everything stopped. No contact.
يعني التهمة كتهمة تهمة باطلة لأنه يعني لو أنا بالفعل كنت ما عديش اعتراف فيها.
There were false accusations. Because if they had been able to prove them, I would have been sentenced to life in prison, not for 15 years.
I used to walk by the Ramla prison every day on my way to work. And I was having thoughts whether I should go and check if Bashir was in that prison, because it's a very large prison for long-term prisoners. And I never did it. You think of it every day, you know. But yeah, I felt very betrayed, and it was too much for me.
I did not confess, and they could not extract a confession from me. However, I am Palestinian. I have always hated occupation. And I believe that I have the right to resist it by the means that are available to me. Yes, at one stage, the means were violent. But I understood them. I understood the actions of the Palestinian fighters who are ready to sacrifice themselves. I still understand them.
I believed he was guilty. I still believe so. And I would be the happiest person on earth to be disabused of this notion. Indeed, I was for many years waiting for a letter saying, I never did this, or a conversation. If I did this, I'm very, very sorry. But I never received such a letter. But I am his friend, yes? Am I his friend or not? If I'm his friend, he can tell me frankly, I had nothing whatsoever to do with it. And yet, he belongs to an organization which puts it on its agenda to destroy Israel also through terror actions, so-called armed struggle. Bombing buses and so on, where also Palestinians are, and also Palestinian children can be, because terror is indiscriminate. And I can be on one of these buses, too.
We have suffered many massacres. Duwaymi, Kfar Qasim, Deir Yassin, Sabra al Shatila. In the face of all these massacres, dispossession, if anybody thought that the Palestinian would react like Jesus Christ would have, he is wrong. If I didn't have this deep conviction to the bone marrow in the necessity of hating the occupation, I don't deserve to be a Palestinian. This feeling, political feeling, started at the age of 6 when we were expelled.
As a 6-year-old, they were in Gaza where they had land, and he was playing with a hand grenade.
And we were playing in the neighborhood with kids, and we thought it was a toy. It was a bomb. It exploded in my hand.
And 4 of his fingers were blown out. Now, can you imagine the trauma of a 6-year-old who is sure is playing with a toy and it explodes in his hands? And he is sure that the Zionists have put it there for him or for little children to be blown up. I mean, what kind of an impression does that leave on somebody's mind who later goes and participates in doing pretty much the same to other people?
Those were the gifts, the presence of the Zionist movement to the children of Palestine. If you just start playing with them, they explode.
I never saw his left hand. His left hand is always in his pocket. Have you seen his left hand? You've met him. No, you shook his right hand. You've never seen his left hand. His left hand is hidden, and it's hidden so well, you never know, you've never seen it.
for me. What I lost in bones and flesh in Palestine made me more attached to Palestine. This is what I told them when they wanted to deport me. I said, you are only deporting parts of my body, but there are some parts of my body that you have no control over. It's already there, buried in Palestine, and I am coming back.
When Bashir wrote to me about his hand, I didn't know of this story, actually. I was quite shocked. And I was also shocked that he expressed the conviction that this was left there against Palestinian children as toys that to play with and to be exploded. I was amazed at the intensity of his perception that Zionism was this incredibly evil manifestation, and that this was his experience. And I am a child of Zion. For me, Zion means something very different than it means to him. For me, Zion is the mountain of God. For me, it's an expression of my very ancient longing. For me, it's a word that symbolizes a harbor for my people and our collective expression here. And for him, it's a regime of terror. That's what it is for him. Something that it's an obligation to fight and to resist in every possible way. Because if Zionism for him is a reign of terror, then terrorism is an appropriate answer. And I say that I cannot afford being on that point where you fight one wrong with another wrong. It doesn't lead you anywhere.
We'll continue with the Lemon Tree in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to the Lemon Tree, our story from the Middle East. It's produced by Sandy Tolan.
Bashir spent 15 years in prison for his alleged role in the bombing of the Jerusalem market. Dalia lost touch with the family after cutting off all contact. But she kept thinking of Bashir and the house and their common fate.
Still, during all these 16 years, I was thinking of the tragedy of the vicious circle. Pain, retaliation. It can go on and on. And I also felt that this house belonged to a family, a whole family, you know, of 13 people. I felt a very deep need to acknowledge that. So my mother died in 77 and my father died in 85. I told Yecheskel, my husband, what do you feel about searching out a family? So there was a meeting and I saw Bashir after all these years. So we said, here is the house. How do you envision its future? You know, we were open. We said we are ready to pay reparations, or how do you call it, compensation, for your loss of property, you know. And we knew they couldn't live in the house by Israeli law. So if it's sold, you will get the money of it. And Bashir said, no selling, and no, this is my patrimony, and I don't...
and we agreed, according to my suggestion, to turn the house into a daycare center for Arab children.
I've done something very personal. I wanted to take responsibility for the suffering that my people has caused them, the Palestinian people. I believe that God is God of abundance and not God of scarcity. And therefore, many things are possible.
Hello, welcome to the open house. Here's Bashir and Dalia's house. This is where Bashir and Dalia lived at different times. We are standing near the lemon tree. Unfortunately, the lemon tree is dead. The lemon tree is now, he's 65 years old and he's dead.
The lemon tree died in the summer after many years of decline, and the gardener warned us that the tree is going to die and said, well, this is the nature of things. Things just die on this planet, you know. And still it was such a surprise, pain, such a pain. And when we saw it finally dead, we have left the tree there, bare. And just yesterday when I was there, I picked a shriveled lemon from the ground, and I'm keeping it. one of the last falling, dried up lemons that are falling off the branches. And the tree will stand there as long as it can. It stands there. Trees die standing.
That tree was living in our hearts. And the lemon fruit is not just a fruit. It's the buried childhood in each of us. It is our memories. It is our compassion. It is our country.
And it is my dream that with the Al-Khayri family, we can, when the time is right, we can plant a new sapling lemon tree together.
وتمنيت ألا تكون الدالية الوحيدة وتمنيت أن أعيش لأرى غابة من الداليات وتوقعنا.
I had hoped that you would not be the only dahlia. I had hoped to live to see a forest of dahlias. And we had many expectations. I don't want to overburden you, Dahlia. I know how sensitive you are. I don't wish you any pain. All what I wish, Dahlia, is for you to struggle with me, to reunite me with my palm. My palm that has blended with every grain of Palestinian soil.
جمعي بكفي كفي الملتحمة بكل ذرة من ذرات تراب فلسطين مع خالص التقدير لكم.
I love my country and you love your country. And I love your country too, and it is the same country. And I have nowhere else to go, and you have nowhere else to go. So we are here, and nobody will dream the other way. And our enemy is the only partner we have.
A postscript. A few months ago, Bashir's mother died in the West Bank town of Ramallah. Dahlia and her husband went to pay their respects. She hadn't seen Bashir in 10 years, since he'd been deported by the Israeli government for being an organizer of the Palestinian uprising, or Intifada. Bashir says if there were more Dahlias willing to consider a Palestinian's right to return from exile, there could be a real and just peace. He still advocates one secular democratic state in all of old Palestine. Dahlia says she won't be ready for that for quite a while, at least not until Bashir renounces the use of violence as a means of political change. As for the house in Ramleh, it remains a daycare center for the Arab children of Israel and a place of encounter for Arabs and Jews.
The Lemon Tree was produced by Sandy Tolan of Homelands Productions as part of the public radio series World Views. It was edited by Chris Brooks and Chris Ballman. Original music composed and performed by Dorothy Wang. Our thanks to WGBH Uplink engineer Alan Mattis. For a tape of the Lemon Tree program, call this special number, 1-800-381-2717. That's 1-800-381-2717. The Lemon Tree, the story of Dalia Landau and Bashir Al-Khari, was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is Fresh Air. Robert Downey Jr. has a reputation for being a bad boy, on and off the screen. In James Toback's new movie, Two Girls and a Guy, Downey plays a guy with serious woman trouble. Film critic John Powers has a review.
James Toback broke onto the Hollywood scene in the mid-1970s. Those heady days when filmmakers believed that movies were a way of exploring one's most personal obsessions. Ever since his first film, Fingers, where Harvey Keitel played a concert pianist with the heart of a thug, Toback has spent his career pursuing libidinous, high-octane themes like gambling and violence, death and sex. He's up to his old tricks in Two Girls and a Guy, a wildly uneven new comedy about infidelity. The movie has a terrific opening gambit. It begins on the street outside a Soho apartment building, where we meet two young women, tiny brunette Lou, played by Natasha Gregson-Wagner, and gawky blonde Carla. That's Heather Graham, who is Roller Girl in Boogie Nights. Both Carla and Lou are waiting for their boyfriends, but they soon discover that they're actually waiting for the same man, a small-time actor named Blake, who's professed his love to them both in exactly the same words. Seeking revenge, they break into his loft and wait to confront him. But when Blake shows up, in the form of Robert Downey Jr., he's as slippery as a blob of mercury. And after his initial shock, he launches into self-serving lies, gliding effortlessly from fibs to whoppers. His chutzpah leaves the women enraged but strangely fascinated, as when they ask Blake if he's had other women, too.
I've lied about nothing except sexual fidelity.
Oh, well, that's really nothing, isn't it? I mean, it's hardly worth mentioning. It's one tiny little infinitesimal glitch on the radar screen.
Yeah, and what do you mean about sexual fidelity? Do you mean that it was just the two of us for the last year?
That I was lying to, yeah.
Oh, that you were lying to. But what about casual acquaintances that you didn't have to lie to because they didn't care what you did or who you did it with?
There's a few. Oh, there's very few.
How few is very few?
Five. Seven, sorry, seven. It was less than 10.
Less than 10?
Two Girls and a Guy is Toback's first movie in 8 years, and it finds him striving for a new tenderness and humor. His work has always glorified male excess. It's not for nothing that he scripted Bugsy. And here he tries to tweak the puritanical 90s by showing the secrets and lies that lurk in our cozy notions of monogamy. The movie's laced with raunchy talk, dirty sex shot in silhouette, and big ideas exploding like flashbulbs. When it comes to sex, Toback suggests, we're all duplicitous and we're all performers. Such an idea should make for a rude, juicy free-for-all. But after a fast start, Two Girls and a Guy turns stagey and awkward, like one of those off-Broadway plays that confuse yakking about sexual relationships with actually exploring them. In person, Toback loves to boast about his tireless philandering. But womanizing should never be confused with actually being interested in individual women. While Carla and Lou are different types, the former brainy and sophisticated, the latter street smart but crass, both serve primarily as a backboard against which Blake can play verbal ping pong. This doesn't hurt Graham, whose melancholy beauty invests Carla with an unearned gravity, but it's murder on Wagner, a sweet-natured actress who flounders as the brittle Pixie Lou. Toback obviously sees himself in Downey, who also played his hero in The Pickup Artist, and the movie offers up Blake as the model of the protean performing self. Toback encourages his star to morph from mood to mood like a chameleon on amphetamines. Blake quotes Hamlet, plays the piano, threatens suicide, bursts into song, keeps phoning his mother, yes, he's fixated, and even woos Carla into a furtive bout of love. It's a bravura piece of showmanship, but the result is ultimately little more than a stunt, the flamboyant display of male plumage. Whatever emotional weight Blake carries comes not from the movie itself, but from our sense of Downey's personal self-destructiveness. The run-amok energy of his acting is fraught with a level of denial deeper than anything Toback gets at. Two Girls and a Guy tries so hard to go beyond predictable Hollywood fare that I wish I could say it were good. But on Blake's wall, there's a huge poster for a film that really is good. Jules and Jim, the classic tale of two guys and a girl. Each time the camera caught a glimpse of this poster, I wished I were watching Truffaut's great exploration of freedom and love, rather than Toback's ornate justification for screwing around.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Fred Snyder, Bob Purdick, and Chris Fraley. Our theme music was created by the Microscopic Septet. Tomorrow would have been Ella Fitzgerald's 80th birthday. Here's a recording from the Harold Arlen Songbook. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Maybe I can't live to love you as long as I want to. Life isn't long enough, baby, but I can love you as long as I live. Maybe I can't give you diamonds and things like I want to, but I can promise you, baby, I'm gonna want you as long as I live. I never cared, but now I'm scared. I won't live long enough. That's why I wear my rubbers when it rains and eat an apple every day, then see the doctor anyway. What if I can't live to love you as long as I want to? Long as I promise you, baby, I'm gonna love you as long as I live.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, getting the inside look on America's favorite pastime, we talk with Fox Sports commentator and former Philadelphia Philly, Tim McCarver. His new book is Baseball for Brain Surgeons and Other Fans. Join us for the next Fresh Air.